September 24th Finance Committee to order. I would ask for a motion for approval of the agenda. Mr. Arquette, Mr. Denisha, all in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. I would ask for a motion for approval of the minutes of the August 27th Finance Committee. Mr. Perkins, second. Mr. Burke, all in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. So we've got Gary and Gary with us tonight for a presentation on the J&L Steel site, so let's go ahead and turn that over to them.
Good evening. I guess I have to use this so they can record me and hold everything I say against me. So good evening. My name is Gary McCulloch. I'm the regional spill engineer for New York State DEC in Watertown. With me is Matt Duffany of my staff. He's going to help me with my presentation tonight. Real quick, I'm a St. Lawrence County guy. I grew up in Governor, went to school in Canton and Potsdam. Now I'm down in the big Jefferson County. Matt's a southern boy. He grew up down in Lafargeville, you know, way below the county. So we're around. We've grown up here. We know the issues here. I wanted to give you a quick presentation on the Jones and Laughlin J&L Steel site up in Star Lake, just so you have an idea what's going on. I know everybody kind of knows about it, but we've had some renewed emphasis on that in the last year or so, and I just wanted to make sure folks knew where we were, and give you a chance to ask questions about what we're doing if you've got any. So I'm going to give you a really quick history. I want to blow through this and make sure that we've got some time for questions later. But basically, in the mid-1800s, there was a survey crew out in the middle of nowhere, and they found a large iron ore deposit. By the late 1800s, 1888, they did some exploration mining at the site. It wasn't the first iron ore in the region. There's actually a couple other iron mines in the Adirondacks. But it was the first one to start delivering concentrated oil to the refineries or to the smelters. So it was an enriched product that made it a lot more cost-effective. Cost-effective in St. Lawrence County, everybody knows, is kind of a relative term. Shipping anything out of here to anywhere else gets really expensive. So the mine really operated in fits and starts through the early part of the 20th century, kind of closed operation. It resumed again somewhere in 1941, and don't hold me to the dates, please. I'm going to try to hit them the best I can, but I mean, this is not really a history lesson. But in support of the war effort, the federal government actually came in, sunk some resources into the facility, put in a whole new ore concentration process. And then at the close of the war, the federal government acquired the land, sold it to the company that was doing all of that production work, and they continued to operate. You know, with that infusion of the federal money, they had something to build on. But even then, they went into the 1970s and just couldn't compete with the rest of the worldwide iron ore market. And they ceased operations for good in 1978. This is an overview of the site. That big J-shaped lake is the mine, the big pit mine that's there. Over here in bright yellow is the one of the tailings piles. There's another tailings pile here down by the transfer station. And this is the site where all of the ore work was done. It's important, as you folks talk about things later, that there's really two entities involved. There's a Benson mine that owns all of the land, like 3,500 acres. They own all of the mineral rights. And then there's J&L, which was a separate corporation that actually conducted the mining and did all of the iron ore processing. There's another site. This is a fairly new picture of the site. Little river flows through on one side of the site. This is the area that we're working with. This is the area where there's the most oil in the ground, and the county-owned portion of land kind of strips right through here. quick history of what DEC did. 1987, there was a spill reported to our hotline. Fishermen found that fish coming out of the little river, out of the Yasogachi River, had an oil smell and oil taste to them. Our folks didn't quite believe it, went up, took a look, and the river was actually just coated in fuel oil. For about a year and a half, we had folks out there with contractors trying to suck oil off the surface of the water. And after doing that for a year and a half and sucking up 1,000 gallons at a time, and more oil just keeps coming, we realized this is much bigger than that. So that was about a decade after they ceased operation. So it kind of took that long for oil in the ground to migrate across the site into the river. This is a picture from about 1991, I'm going to say. There's oil running down the river here. This big gerrymandered thing is actually a chalk line on site where we surveyed in the old stream channel. When you go up through Route 3, you notice a lot of those bog flow areas. The rivers kind of meander. That's what this would have looked like originally before they kind of changed the site for their use. The other reason I show this picture, if you look at the buildings up along Route 3, you know, this is 10, 12 years, 15 years after the mine ceased and the operations at the site ceased. Those don't really look that bad. That first 15 years, things didn't really deteriorate the way they did a few years after that. So the first couple of years, like I said, we sucked a lot of oil off the river. We put in a recovery well, drilled down into the ground, tried to extract oil from there. That was marginally successful for a while. 1994 was kind of a big event. DEC commissioned the installation of a 1,500-foot-long curtain wall of high-density polyethylene sheeting, a big plastic sheet along the river's edge, about 15 feet down, to keep the oil floating on the groundwater up on the site and keep it from running into the river. That kind of gave us the opportunity to take a step back and worry about how are we going to get this oil out of the ground and worry less about the oil running into the river. It really cut off most of the oil running into the river. Late 90s, we installed a series of shallow recovery trenches into the groundwater about 12 feet deep, and over the course of 8 or 9 years sucked 350,000 gallons of oil out of the ground. This here, there's a couple of large storage tanks, put the oil into tanks. This is a 10 kilowatt generator. We were recovering about 1,000 gallons of oil a week and burning 1,000 gallons of oil a week in a generator, burning it straight up after sucking it out of the ground. Ran it through a couple of sediment filters. It was straw colored, just like it came out of the pump. Things kind of stalled. We found that our recovery rates fell off. We weren't able to get as much oil out of the ground. We knew that if we were going to try to get more out, it was going to cost us a lot of money. Somewhere around 2004, the county entered our environmental restoration program to try to look for some funding that way. By 2007, we really weren't squeezing any oil out of the ground, and that just happened to coincide with a big economic crunch. That put a big hit on our state spill fund, and we just didn't have the money to invest in anything that was anything more than pure protection of human health impacts, you know, spills that were getting people's drinking water and that type of thing. Anything discretionary kind of fell off the plate. Buildings are really falling into disrepair at that point. Along with that environmental restoration program that gave us, we got eyes on some other parts of the site. We started to look and say, is there more than oil here? Is there a hazardous waste problem? We did find some minor areas of hazardous waste, but really the good news was it was a really big oil spill, second largest oil spill in the history of New York State. But that was really all it was, is one big oil spill, some ancillary hazardous waste problems, but nothing that was difficult to correct. I put this in here, it's kind of got that gloomy look. This is somewhere in the winter of like 05 when we had ceased some of our efforts, and you know the buildings are really falling down, and we're not accomplishing anything at that point. You know, DEC wasn't accomplishing anything in terms of cleanup. That was kind of where things stalled. Is that you? So Matt's going to give you an idea of what we've done in the last couple of years to kind of ramp things back up again and start doing some cleanup.
Thanks, Gary. Yeah, click that. So my name is Matt Duffany. I work out of the Watertown office. I'm an engineer. I'm the project manager for all the work that we're doing on site right now for the department here out of the region that pertains to the oil spill cleanup portion of it. I know there has been a lot of activity there recently, cars in and out. There's been a lot of stuff going on down the hill. If you haven't had a chance to go visit it yet or miss the earlier opportunities, it's really something to see for sure. Next. And this is an abbreviated version of another presentation, so I took out all the fun graphics and videos and stuff, but we'll do our best. Gary mentioned the EPA investigated the site earlier. Part of that investigation actually opened our eyes to a much deeper oil plume than we thought. This purple-pink area is actually a submerged layer of oil. So what we have is a shallow layer of oil at the site. Then we have what we're calling a marsh mat, which is basically the bottom of that bog that Gary mentioned with the Jerry Meander there. Underneath that's another layer of oil that's deeper. And it's this deeper layer that we had really no idea about previously. And so that, no, you're good. So that drove all the work that we went to do in 2018. EPA did provide a conceptualization, and this is what they believe may have happened. We're not exactly sure of it, but it gives you a general idea. We had tanks at the bottom of the hill. It was piped up to the furnaces. As it came back down, water level was decreased over the years. We're not sure how much, but we believe that oil layer was actually split into that shallow layer that Gary alluded to earlier, the low-hanging fruit, that 350,000 gallons, by basically sticking some pipe in the ground. And this is kind of the stuff that really caught our eye as far as it's going to be a long-going, ongoing issue into the river itself. So based on that information, we knew that we wanted to confirm it, and we wanted to see if any of it was actually recoverable. So we were very fortunate. We were able to retain a local contractor, NRC, formerly Optech. They're kind of a staple. Some other guys worked on this back in the 80s and 90s throughout this whole process previously. Gave us that flexibility we really needed to make decisions on the fly based on field conditions. All right, so on a nice, brisk February day, we headed out and kind of did what we do best, which is digging holes. So we dug some big holes. This one here on the left is down about 20, 25 feet below grade. This is actually trench boxes on top of trench boxes. See this yellow, greenish oil? That's from that deeper layer, that confining unit. I don't have the video on here, but when we actually punctured through that, it bubbled right up out of the ground. It's actually under pressure below the ground. This one here on the right is the stuff that we've been seeing for years. This is ground level here, so this is about 5 to 6 feet below grade. Comes in just as fast as you can take it out. Really interesting stuff. So now that we confirmed that it was there and that we think we could get it, we shifted gears to design. So a lot of March and April consisted of design for the remedial trench. Go ahead, Gary. And we broke ground on the trench in mid-April. We were on average running 7 staff a day, 5 days a week, and usually 2 on the weekends as well to keep ahead of the water management for the site. Again, all local resources that made all of our lives easier, kept my budget in check, and provided us the flexibility we needed. Steve Trim out of Norfolk was retained for the hauling. We had Cook's Gravel in Sprague-ville. They provided this specialized stone that we called in for the trench. All the piping was from Holland Supply and Messina. It was nice because between these contractors and Optech, it provided a nice sense of community participation. Always something to talk about at the gas station. Lots of good words out there besides just us saying it, but the community kind of seeing that as well. And I'm sure they were happy for the work in March as well, because most of those were still shuttered typically. Just some quick pictures. This is one of the corner manholes cutting in. They have little cutouts. This is about 12 feet deep. Essentially a very robust version of the one that Gary mentioned earlier that was kind of put in on a shoestring budget. This trench cost us approximately $850,000, I believe. Yeah. So we started off, and there's lots of stuff in between, but anyways, at the end of the day, here's an overlay of that old riverbed. This is a general location of our current recovery trench. We have these little spurs in strategic areas to gather shallow oil. If you remember back on the previous slide, way back, the deeper oil is right here. So this was put in as a primary recovery for that shallow layer, but also it was installed with defense in mind in case anything happened that stopped that confining unit or compromised it. If any of that deeper oil came up through here, we would have this as kind of our own secondary line of defense, as well as EPA's interceptor trench that is in the ground now and also runs along parallel to the river. Just some numbers in total. That trench was about a third of a mile, 1,650 linear feet, 7,600 tons of contaminated soil out just for the trench itself, 1.4 million gallons of water treated, also 5,500 gallons of oil that was unintentionally recovered. Now, when I say that, I don't mean that we're actively trying to get it. That's 5,500 gallons we had to move out of our way just so we'd get pipe in the ground. So that certainly was encouraging, to say the least. All right, go ahead. Don't click it yet. So here's just a little flyover drone, which unfortunately already is dated because we have some of these buildings that are already down now. But if you click that, on June 8th, we finished the trench, and this is how everything looks after regrading. This is starting below the hill. State Route 3 is over here on the right. Little River's way over there on the left. As you proceed down in, this is the location of the former tanks, centering furnaces up top. There's that plume. These little concrete Cheerios, my kids called them, they're what were in place for the access to our trench, and actually runs in this rectangle around. A Connex box there and there. Those have that original 4,000-gallon recovery tanks associated with the original system. Those big tanks are in that red shed that Gary showed the picture of with the generator. And I think this is important to show that we say a trench or a ditch. I mean, this is a pretty substantial ditch, to say the least. Comes around the bend here, and then we'll see that actually this is when EPA was working on their trench as well. Give you some perspective on where theirs lies relative to ours. So the corner of ours is in the corner of this Connex box. You can see right here some of the open portion of the EPA interceptor trench. Following along with these manholes, over here we have the extensive groundwater treatment that we had to do to put the trench in. We have the little river here. You see the iron ochre and the orange discoloring in there, the boom as well. I mean, the resources obtained for this, we have 4-inch pumps, 6-inch pumps. Again, these buildings are down now. It's a heck of a view when you go out there. But just to put a little perspective on the scale of what this effort entailed, and these guys, again, were doing it from April to June. So I give them a lot of credit. All right, so in February, we set out our goals for the year. We completed the shallow trench. We are now collecting that oil layer from the shallow zone. We did want to explore deeper. So what we did, we worked hand-in-hand with EPA on this one. Next week, they're actually going to be installing 12 deep 6-inch recovery wells for that deeper zone with the intent of seeing how much we can actually get back. We can do pump tests and make the most of our weather here before stuff starts freezing in a couple of months. So we've recovered about 7,700 gallons of oil to date. But again, we're not really even trying to recover so much now as we're trying to get all this work done before the snow flies. So once we do start really trying into it, we're We're encouraged. All said and done for this calendar year, I anticipate we're going to be just shy of about $2.4 million that Region 6 DEC has put into this project so far. And with that, I'll hand it back to Gary.
So, sorry, we're kind of racing through here, but we want to be able to get through and get to some questions and other stuff. Back to kind of that history, and we kind of glossed over the EPA thing really quickly, but about 2010, in an effort to move this along, our regional director at the time, Judy Drubicki, was pretty instrumental in forming a stakeholder group, partly with some pressure from the county to say, you know, what's going on? Are you guys ever going to do anything here? But we have a bunch of different agencies involved, and in order to keep everybody on task, we have a conference call once a month just to say, hey, what did you do this month? You said you were going to do XYZ. Why didn't you do it? EPA got interested as part of the asbestos removal. There was one building that had a significant asbestos issue, and they came in to do that abatement work. They also got interested in the oil, and they started putting a lot of horsepower, a lot of money into looking at the oil contamination issue. What they found, though, was there's a lot of oil in the ground, but it didn't appear to really be a threat of migration to the Little River, to the Oswegatchie River. Federal law is all based on Clean Water Act. It has to track back to navigable waters. They don't really regulate groundwater. New York State does. So what they gave us for their investment, they spent a lot of time and a lot of money on it, but what they really gave us was a much more detailed understanding of the site. They didn't really do much cleanup. They did put in an interceptor trench along the little river. It's kind of a better system than that poly curtain that we had installed, but it's really just a defensive measure to keep oil from getting into the river. They said there's really not oil that's recoverable, and the oil that's there really isn't a threat to navigable water. We chose to disagree with that and said, you know, I think there's a lot of oil in the ground, and I think we can get it out of the ground. Our state spill fund is robust. You know, back in 08, we didn't have any money. Now the coffers are kind of overflowing. Oil's moving more than it was back then. Some of the crude oil movement, we've taxed that differently. There's a bunch of weird things going on with that. But we've got more money coming in than we used to have. So we're going to use it to try to clean this up. I want to try to move from JNL into some of the other work that we're doing, but I think it's relevant. Like I said, we have this stakeholder group, and it's there so that people can inform each other what they're doing, what's going on with the building demolition, how does that affect what we're doing with the oil spill cleanup. It holds people accountable for the things that they said they were going to do. Our central office is also involved. We're trying to get as much oil as we can get out of the ground, the free floating oil in the ground. Once that's done, there's still a lot of oil in the ground. You know, when we're sucking oil out as a free separate product, we're lucky if we get about 50%. You know, if you spill 1,000 gallons of oil in the ground, I can probably get 500 back out of the ground. After that, it's stuck to the soil. It's starting to dissolve into the groundwater. It's in the ground in ways that you can't just suck it out. We figure there was about a million gallons of oil spilled over the time frame that oil was being lost in the ground. We've recovered about 350. We think there's substantial oil we can get out of the ground before we have to start worrying about those residual levels. Once we're done with that, we're concurrent to that. Albany is also kind of looking on that, the more engineered strategy of what's really left. Is it a problem? Is it a problem for the environment? Is it a problem for human receptors? Is it an impediment to development? That's a lot more protracted process of engineers and work plans and feasibility studies. They're working on that feasibility study piece right now. They're saying of all the remedial techniques that are out there, which ones may or may not be appropriate for this site. And that's going to kind of dovetail also with what's your reasonably anticipated future use of the site. And I think that's really where the county comes in pretty heavily. We're here to kind of bridge that gap between Albany and the county and make sure that that feasibility selection process includes the county's needs and all of that, both as the property owner, hopefully someday as the property seller to somebody that's going to do something there to, you know, bring some jobs back to the community. We want to make sure that as we do our work, we're certainly not an impediment to somebody developing that site. We want to be there to do something constructive to help them be able to develop the site. Some of the money we've spent, our initial spill response out there before 1997 was about $1.5 million. We spent another $2 million. So for $3.5 million, we recovered 350,000 gallons of oil. In remedial terms, that's cheap. In normal dollars, that's a lot of money. But for the work that we do, if you can get oil out of the ground for $100 a gallon, you're doing really well. The environmental restoration program, the hazardous waste work, was another $1.5 million. Like I said, there really wasn't a huge problem in that area. Some of the additional work that we've done, we got about $2.4 million. We're expecting to spend another $4 to $6 million in the next 5 years getting oil out of the ground, and probably more than that, another $4 to $8 million, maybe $10 million on that long-term remedy to get to the point where we can say that we're done. No, I didn't have them on there. They've spent another $5 million in the work that they did. Thank you, Karen. Oh, there they are. You just had to wait a slide. EPA spent about $1 million in their asbestos abatement job, another $5 million on the site, and then the county through all of its, all of Heidi's work tying all the different pieces of money here and there, another $3 million on building demolition. So we're into it for 25 or 30 by the time we're done. It's a lot of money, most I've ever been involved with, but it kind of pales in comparison to some of the big hazardous waste sites that can go 10 times that. So what do you get for that kind of money? Hopefully, very soon, you get all those dilapidated buildings down, resolved all of the hazardous waste issues, resolved a lot of the liability issues through the county attorney's office and your outside counsel, Gary Bowich. You're able to get that release from liability that hopefully somebody else can take that site and do something productive with it. We will have removed all of the free phase petroleum out of the ground. If you think about a sponge, you suck up a bunch of water with a sponge, and then you give it a good squeeze, and then you let go, and it doesn't drip water anymore. That's what we're looking for when it comes to oil. Basically, we're going to squeeze all of the oil that we can get out of the ground so that if you dug in, you wouldn't see oil running into the ground. You might have oil-contaminated material, just like you still have a wet sponge, but it's not going to drip oil anymore. But the site will be suitable for redevelopment, probably with some restrictions. And what we're interested in exploring with the county is the highest and best use. You know, we could clean up that site with tablespoons and get it to the point where, you know, you could put a residential community there. But is that really the highest and best use of that site? Besides being ridiculously expensive to get to that point, you've got an industrial zoned site in the Adirondack Park. It has certain advantages that go with that. And I think an industrial development is consistent also with the work we're doing. Think about it on a small scale. You know, if you have a gas station and their tanks leak and they have all this contamination, and then you do a cleanup and you don't get it completely cleaned up, doesn't it make sense to put another gas station there? So at least if there's a problem, you're not recontaminating a new greenfield somewhere. You know, you're working on a site that's already got some environmental blight to it. So these large industrial sites, we see this across the state. They bring with them a lot of challenges. There's a big environmental impact, but there's a bigger social economic impact. The loss of 1,000 jobs at JNL, it was a disaster for that community. So now you've got a community with no work and blighted falling down buildings and an environmental disaster all tied together. And that's not unique. That's all of these old industrial sites that end up in this condition have all of those things in common. They're expensive to fix, and they require multiple funding sources. What you're seeing at JNL is, you know, not one person can do that site. Not one agency can clean that up. It's taken a piece here, a piece there, and by bringing all of those stakeholders together, you start to build that momentum to the point where, you know, if you're the one agency and you've got an extra $1 million laying around and everybody else just spent 25, you know, they're going to say, come on, you know, give us your million. So it requires a multi-jurisdictional remedy, requires multi-discipline remedies. You know, you've got people working on the environmental groundwater issues and folks that are doing demolition, different people with different expertise all coming together to try to fix the entire problem instead of trying to fix it a piece at a time, which really wasn't working well. The county was right to be frustrated 15 years ago when things weren't really moving because everybody was trying to fix all their individual pieces rather than fix it comprehensively. So I wanted to move from there and use that same idea with some of the other work that's before the Finance Committee, with some of the abandoned gas station work that we're doing. And I'll jump back and we can open it up for some questions, but I just wanted to kind of, while you're thinking in that line, a lot of these gas station sites are really just like JNL. They're just a lot smaller, you know, but they exist in your communities. They exist in downtown Canton, in Potsdam, in Messina. And they still have those common factors of the blight and the environmental impact, everything else. Just so you know where DEC was coming from through some of this, our petroleum bulk storage tank regulations came out in the mid-1980s. And if you've got people with tanks in the ground and you tell them, well, you have to test them to make sure they're not leaking, you're going to find out that they're leaking. We had a huge workload with all these leaking underground tanks. St. Lawrence County was particularly problematic for us because so many communities are kind of the hub of a wheel with farms all around them, and then they're isolated from all the other areas. So you didn't have public water available. At one time, my office was managing, I think, 400 homes with individual carbon treatment systems in their homes because their wells were contaminated with gasoline, and half of those were in St. Lawrence County. Every little hamlet, we were chasing down contaminated drinking water supplies. You'd get one phone call gives you years and hundreds of thousands of dollars worth of work to do. We were not focusing on things like the blight of abandoned gas stations. We were worried about people drinking gasoline. And it took a long time to get over that, to get to the point where we could clean up the source of that problem and or find replacement wells or connect somebody to a water line extension or something and get rid of the public health threat first. We kind of got through that. About the time we did was in that 08 time frame when our funding just fell off a cliff. So we said, wow, we've actually got the worst problems taken care of. Now let's go do something else good. There's no money to do it. You know what the impacts are. The cost to clean up the site is probably an order of magnitude more than what the site is worth. I started with DEC spill response in Albany. You know, we had this guy that had a gas station on the corner, and it cost a couple $100,000 to clean it up, and it was really tough. You know, I mean, the guy's out of business, all the things that go with that. A couple years later, he sold the place for $4 million. I don't begrudge him making money on his site, but I mean, you know, it's it was horrible. I mean, it was just a mom and pop gas station, and he was kind of destroyed. But then property values went like this in Albany, and that fixed that problem for them. I talked to my counterparts in a lot of other parts of the state, and they say, "What's the big deal? I mean, Rite Aid comes in and they spend $500,000. They clean it up. You're good to go." Once in a while, we get lucky, and Stewart's or Fast Track or somebody will do that. But there's a lot of sites they don't want. When you've got a community like, I was talking to a historian in Carthage. At one time, there were 26 gas stations in Carthage. I mean, everybody could make a buck. I grew up at a gas station. I was literally born and came home to the gas station. Anybody could sell gas. Sorry about that. So anyway, we get to today, and probably the last 5 or 6 years, I give St. Lawrence County a lot of credit because they're really ahead of the curve on this in looking at these abandoned sites and saying, let's start picking them off. We can complain about the problem, but we can also work on fixing the problem. So we've been putting forth quite a bit of effort, quite a bit of money. Out of the five counties that I covered, St. Lawrence, Jefferson, Lewis, Oneida, and Herkimer, 3 or 4 years ago, probably 80% of the money that I was spending was up here because you guys were moving and nobody else was. Now other people are seeing your success and they want a piece of that too. But that's okay. We've got sites in the pipeline. We've got places like MR Bell. Again, it's that multiple agencies, multiple legal entities, village, town, county, DEC, all kind of coming together saying, okay, we can take care of this piece if you guys take care of this piece. And it's showing some real success. So by taking care of a lot of those public health problems, we're able to switch our focus to dealing with more of the blighted sites. The state had its environmental restoration program. It offered some success. Came with a lot of legal baggage. You had to hire an attorney, and not all attorneys are bad. Had to hire an engineer. You had to jump through a lot of hoops to get to that point. You got really good legal protections at the end, but you also got a pretty expensive project for what it did. We've had some really good success, and really St. Lawrence County has pioneered a lot of the success with going to the state spill fund and saying, you're never going to get all your money back. You're never going to get very much of your money back. Let's be smart about this. Let's clean up the site, figure out some kind of mechanism to get at least a token reimbursement for the money that's been spent, get a release from liability that can be given to the new property owner, get the place back on the tax rolls, and get some business going again. And that's been very successful. We started by doing our cleanup before the release was issued. Our fund administrator was worried about writing me a blank check, or writing anybody a blank check that says, sure, I'll give you a release, go ahead and clean up the site. So we had to kind of start slowly. We would do the cleanup. I would go to the fund and say, I'm going to spend $200,000 on this cleanup. And then we would spend $180,000 and then say, okay, now let's settle an agreement. We tried to be really careful with our estimates. Tried to show the fund that we knew what we were doing, and if it was going to be expensive, we knew it was going to be expensive. If it was going to be 500 grand, we told them it was going to be 500 grand. We've been fairly accurate with that, and so that's put some confidence in us from them, so that they're now willing to entertain a release before we do the work. One of the real advantages with that is you've got a gas station, tanks out front, the gas is in the ground. A bunch of it runs underneath the gas station. If we have to clean up the site and you still have a blighted gas station sitting there, now what? Maybe you can come up with a way to knock the building down, but now you've got contamination there and we have to come back in and do some more cleanup. It got a little bit harder than it needed to be, but we needed to be able to show that we were going to do what we said we were going to do in a way that we said we were going to do it. Now we're able to get that release from liability first. that enables the county or the the county to take ownership of the site. Now that you own it, the building can come down, whether that's through you. You know, there are cases where I can say that the structure is an impediment to the cleanup, so I can take the building down. We would never mess around with things like taking down a building that belonged to somebody else. You know, that's just a huge constitutional no-no, and I won't go there. But if the county owns the building, we'll knock it down in some cases. In some cases, we'll say it's really not in our way. We'll do the cleanup. You knock the building down. But it gives us a place to start where we can control all of those factors and get that cleanup done. So it gives us the ability to get the dilapidated building down, and it goes back to that whole idea of a comprehensive, multi-jurisdictional approach to solve the whole problem at once. So I hope I didn't scream too fast, but I wanted to get to the point where we could open it up. If any of you folks have any questions on what we're doing either at JNL or in that broader initiative, feel free to fire away.
Mr. Akers.
Gary, where's the contaminated soil at the JNL site? Where did you have to remove that to?
We sent that to mostly Rodman. Yeah, we sent that to Rodman. We weren't taking contaminated soil there for the purpose of cleaning up the site. It was in order to dig those trenches in. We generated 7,000 tons of contaminated soil that had to go somewhere. We didn't want to leave it on site.
Okay.
I mean, we could have found a way, but the surface of JNL is actually pretty clean. All of the contamination's in the ground. So I think I'm on. Sorry about that.
Yeah.
We didn't want to take contamination in the ground, pile it on the ground, and make other things worse, so that went to Rodman.
The other question I have is, what are the sources of the money that's moving into the spill fund now that you have an abundance of funding now?
So trying to figure out how to say this quickly. When we In 2008, there was a directive that came down from the governor that said that all agencies had to reduce their spending on non-personal services costs. And there became a dispute that our spill fund was non-personal services rather than contractual. So non-personal services is our trucks, our boots, our hard hats. And somebody said, well, we can't live without that stuff, so we'll pretend that the spill fund that doesn't even belong to DEC, it's actually managed separately by the comptroller, is our non-personal services money. So they just lopped $12 million off that. They couldn't take the money away. It was foolish. They couldn't take the money away. They could remove our appropriation to spend it. So instead of spending $20 million a year, we were spending 12, and our balance increased. All the money was there. We spent all the money we always did, but we played some shell games to pretend we didn't spend some money.
But it's taxpayer money, though.
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Yep. It's an excise tax on all the petroleum that comes into the state. The second place where we got a lot of extra money, there's on that excise tax, it's 13 and a half or so cents per 42-gallon barrel of oil that comes into the state. There was a reduced tax for oil that's transshipped that comes into the state and then moves on and doesn't stay here. So it goes into a storage tank and then it moves on to another state. We didn't tax that very heavily. It only happened like in New York City, stuff going over to New Jersey. But it started happening a lot with the crude oil. It would bring it in by rail from Minnesota, drive it over to Albany, put it in a tank, move it from there into a ship, and move it down to refineries like in Philadelphia. We were so worried. I mean, New York State is about the only state I know of that didn't have a massive derailment and explosion and loss of a quarter to a half a million gallons of fuel from this Bakken crude oil being shipped by train. I mean, it was coming our way. It just never actually happened. So they quick passed legislation that instead of getting the 2.5 cents a barrel on transshipped, they shoved that up to the full 13 cents because we said we need to build up our coffers because if one of these things happens, we need to have the money available. And then, you know, the price went down, they quit shipping the oil, we keep bringing the money in. So we're actually in the reverse problem. There's a statutory maximum of how much money can be in the spill fund. We're dangerously close to that, and they're actually very thankful for some of the work we're doing up here, because when we exceed that cap, we actually stop collecting that excise tax completely until the fund bottoms out to a different number, and then they start again. And nobody wants to be the guy that reinstitutes a tax that they stopped collecting, so we'd rather get some good work done while we've got the money to do it.
One final question I have. Was the fill pipe that went to the tanks, was that made out of wood that they were actually pumping the fuel in?
Some speculation, but what we think happened, what I think happened, I'm not going to say we because maybe nobody else thinks like me. The original process to concentrate the iron ore was coal-fired. I think they used a lot of water. That was probably a water pipe that was going up there for stuff. In the 40s, when they redid the whole facility, it ran on fuel oil. Most of those systems are going to use a pressurized supply line and a gravity return line. You know, if you've got a furnace, older, they don't do them so much. Mostly they're straight suction. 20 years ago, you always had a supply and return line. That line, that wooden pipe really appears that oil was flowing through it, and the only conceptually good reason for that to happen was somebody was using pressurized iron pipe to feed the boilers, and that return line for the unburned oil was running wood. Down that wooden pipe.
Okay.
Water will make wood swell, but oil won't, so you know it's probably dripping out of there. Or it was an iron return line that had a hole in it. I mean, either way, it was definitely associated with those lines. The picture's not up easily, but you had the tanks at the bottom of the hill, that sintering plant at the top of the hill, underground lines. They were burning a couple million gallons of oil a year. So to lose a percent or two, you're never going to see it, especially in the 60s when fuel was cheap.
Right.
Nobody in the right mind, even when it's cheap, just like pours oil on the ground. So obviously it was leaking into the ground somewhere that nobody knew about and only manifest itself 10 years after they closed the doors. But it may have been leaking all the way back to the 40s. The site's a little bit weird. It's mainly built on fill. A lot of that fill is crushed tailings. It's not really dirt. It's not soil where you've got organic material and biologic activity and stuff going on. So oil will slowly kind of degrade in certain environments. It doesn't degrade here. It looks like the day it went in the ground. And so I can't really tell you, you know, is the oil we're pumping out, did that go into the ground in the 60s and 70s? Has it been happening since the 40s? It's kind of hard to say. It's been there, and it stays there unadulterated. It's just like the day it went in the ground.
Any other questions? Mr. Denisa.
Mr. Chairman. Gary, you had mentioned that until the site was suitable, the work would continue until the site's suitable for redevelopment. Assuming that we're saying suitable for light industry, best guess as to how long?
It's going to depend on a couple of different factors. One is the level that we're going to get it to, you know, and this is where the county, when I'm gone, can talk more about your visions for what might be there. But with the idea of keeping it light industrial or heavy industrial, you know, we're now kind of at the point where we want to make sure there's no oil in the river, but that's really our only concern. I mean, there's such an environmental destruction there that can't be returned that we're not going to spend money just for the sake of spending money. So if we can clean it up to our industrial cleanup standards, which is about the most forgiving standards that we've got, that's easier than it is to clean it up to a higher degree. And it also kind of, it, part of it is that feasibility study. Not only is that a public process, in its very nature is a public process, but now it's a different kind of public process because the public owns the site. So you're going to have a lot of input with that. And if you have a defensible reason to say, we need this cleaned up within the next 5 or 6 years, then that may steer the approach that's used. If you have kind of a grand scheme that, boy, I hope somebody comes in here and does something great here someday, that might not cut it. But if you've got realistic plans that say you need it cleaned up sooner than later, and then you look at those different alternatives and you say, well, this one's going to cost 10% more, but it's going to be done in 5 years instead of 20. If there's a good reason for that, it's something we'll explore.
Any other questions? All right. Thank you, Gary.
All right. Thank you. I appreciate the chance to come here and speed you through this.
I just wanted to ask, Gary Bowich, I think we should really thank DEC for the effort that they've done and the Oil Spill Fund, who's funding all of this. On the gas station initiative, you know, we've been working on this for quite a long time, but it's sort of the perfect storm. Once we linked up the tax delinquent sites with the money that the spill fund is now and the DEC is now prepared to spend, you know, we're able to, you know, drop these sites and get them back on the tax rolls, get them cleaned up, get them back on the tax rolls. And it, I mean, it is sort of takes a village, but everything sort of came together. I mean, J&L's in and of itself is a separate animal, but we're amazing things are going on there. That's also a community effort. But I think trying to knock these sites off, get them back on the tax rolls, I think we have the DEC, the Spill Fund to thank, and I think it's a really good effort that the county has initiated. This county is, I've worked for other counties, this is way ahead of the curve, and we've done a really good job. So I want to thank everybody here.
Thank you. Ms. Bell is excused for tonight. Moving presentation of resolutions. Need a motion for a resolution for authorization to fill 2 laborer positions in the Department of Highways. Mr. Denisha, second. Mr. Burke.
Thank you. The 2 positions that we have presenting on this resolution resulted from promotions. I had vacancies previously as a bridge in the bridge construction area and also a sign maintenance worker. The positions were both vacated on August 27th due to promotions to those positions, which the board had previously approved.
Any questions or comments? All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries.
Thank you.
I would ask for a motion for a resolution authorizing the chair to sign a contract with Barton and LeJudas DPC to prepare Appendix A for the multi-use trail capital project. Mr. Arquette, second. Mr. Hooper.
Mr. Timmerman, if you don't mind, may I have Deb Christie
come on down
and address this issue, if you don't mind? Thank you.
Thank you, Deb. Okay. So we're asking a resolution tonight to do an Appendix A for a couple additional segments that we want included in the trail. We do have the funding already set aside for that, and we're hoping that you will approve this.
Any questions or comment? All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries.
Thank you, Dan.
Would ask for a motion for a resolution modifying the 2018 budget for the Department of Highways for equipment repair. Mr. Arquette, Mr. Denisha.
Back in May, the Department of Highways was involved in a motor vehicle accident where an individual rear-ended a pickup truck towing one of our sweepers and basically totaled the sweeper. Insurance recovery is in the amount of $14,565, which is approximately the value of the parts. What I would propose to do is actually take that sweeper back and over the winter buy the parts and have mechanical staff at the department rebuild that machine and have it back operational for the spring. Action.
Any questions or comments? All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed?
Thank you.
Ask for a motion for resolution authorizing the chair to apply for state municipal facilities program SAM grant funds to purchase a dump truck for the Department of Highways. Mr. Forsyth, Mr. Lightfoot, Mr. Fay.
Yes, through the Senator Ritchie's office, the Department of Highways was offered a SAM grant for the purchase of a dump truck. The department has purchased a dumping flatbed truck with the funds for this grant, and this is a reimbursement grant, so this money would be coming back into the budget and was anticipated in the 2018 budget.
Mr. Forsyth.
Yeah, Don, does this also act as a dump truck? Do you use it as a plow truck also?
It is not. That would have been much more money than
just
this.
Hope.
But it is a tandem axle dump truck.
Okay.
Any other questions? All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries.
Thank you.
Switching to solid waste, I would ask for a motion for a resolution authorizing the chair to sign documents necessary to accept grant funds for the disposal of tires and authorizing the solid waste transfer stations to accept tires for one day at no charge. Mr. Denisha, second.
Yes.
Mr. Hooper.
Thank you. Again, through Senator Ritchie's office, this is a grant that will address tire take back at no cost to the residents, bringing them to our sites. As you can see, one date has already passed. We held the event this past weekend, and the other is planned for the transfer station, Lisbon / Augsburg transfer station, this Saturday from 12:30 to 4:30.
Mr. Forsyth.
How was the attendance at the last one?
We had plenty of tires, we're working on that right now, but it was very well attended.
Okay.
Anybody else? All in favor? Mr. Perkins.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm not going to support this resolution, not because I don't support recycling. It's the timing of the resolution. This has already been done, at least half of it has. And it's just coming to committee now, not to mention even the full board. So, therefore, I won't be supporting it.
I understand.
Thank you. Anybody else? All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? No. Motion passes.
Thank you.
Thank you, Don. I would ask for a motion for a resolution for adoption of the equalization rates for 2019 county taxes. Mr. Burke. Second, Mr. Lightfoot.
This is a yearly resolution that's asked for that the county EEC rates are adopted by the legislature, showing what the EEC rate is for each town in the city of Augsburg within the county. This is used for apportionment purposes and setting up due to the tax rates.
Any questions? All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. I would ask for a motion for a resolution for authorizing collection of omitted taxes. Mr. Burke, Mr. Fay.
This next resolution is also a yearly resolution that's asked for regarding the collection of omitted taxes. Omitted taxes typically are a tax that an assessor will put together when a property sells that has an exemption on it and the new owner is not entitled to that exemption. Some assessors will go back and tax that, and it's put on the next tax bill. So,
any questions? All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. Thank you. Start with a resolution for the county administrator's report. I would ask for a motion for a resolution designating the St. Lawrence County Chamber of Commerce as the St. Lawrence County Tourism Promotion Agency and authorizing the chair to sign the 2019 contract. Mr. Peckland, Mr. Colbert.
This resolution is the time of year you're typically seeing the request for a tourism promotion agent. This also will allow the contract to be signed in the new format that we provide, whereby we share occupancy tax. That'll be a 5% increase for 2019.
Any questions?
And Brooke is here also, if you have any questions for her as well.
Mr. Lightfoot.
Oh, we'll have to hear from Brooke.
Did you ask a specific question or just want to update?
Don't tell that.
Last year, or for this current budget year, you proposed some ideas on how to generate tourism.
Mm-hmm.
I would like to know what kind of success you've had with those ideas in bringing tourists into the county, particularly as they relate to conferences mm-hmm. and whatnot that you put great emphasis on.
Mm-hmm. So that project idea for really creating a new opportunity for conferences in the area. We've pursued a couple of different things. We've attended a trade show specific to association and meeting planners in Saratoga, created a brochure I think I distributed last time we were here. We've added information on our website. We've had several meetings locally with academic chairs, attended some other meetings on campuses to extend our assistance to help them bolster academic conferences as well. We've got a list of about 30 conferences that we think have potential. I've learned this year it will take longer. We had said that 18 months might be a realistic recruitment window because they always plan 1 to 2 years in advance. We've also learned that our location being on the outsides of where most of the population are presents a challenge for conferences. And so we've fine-tuned our look to be based more closely on regional meetings and retreats versus larger conferences. So our hope is that we'll be able to generate enough regional conferences, might be smaller than the size we were looking at originally, but potentially could have more. So that's where it's at. There's nothing booked right now, but we continue to have to move forward in that goal.
How do you quantify then? Well, let me ask you this. Have you seen any successes in any of your efforts other than these conferences in bringing in additional folks to the area? And if so, how do you quantify it?
We have, I'm trying to think, we do not have anything booked that we know of as a result of our efforts to quantify that. The plan for quantifying it would be the number of attendees times room nights. That's how we would calculate.
Is there any way that you can tell us whether or not we have seen an increase in tourism in St. Lawrence County? And if so, how? How do you attribute it? Is it a dollar amount? Is it or strictly on bed tax and sales tax?
It's right now, really the only numbers we have are our bed tax collection numbers, and so we are seeing that increase. The state numbers that we have are always almost a year behind, so the 2017 numbers out of the New York State Tourism Economics Report show an increase, so that's always good. Just trying to say it's in the resolution, the 2017 Tourism Economics Report numbers. So they noted that spending has increased by 2.5%, state tax by 1.1%, occupancy tax by 3.7%, visitor expenditure has increased, as well as the local taxes. We're also seeing increases in all of our traffic on websites, social media, all the digital platforms that we're on. So that's how we track what we're investing in, more digital marketing, and we're seeing the return on that.
Last question. You say that there is an increase in tourism, and part of it is based on a bed tax. Is that bed tax as a result of additional tourists, or is it a result of the efforts of not only the St. Lawrence County Chamber, but people here in the county, of going out and identifying people that are renting their facilities out that hadn't previously collected the sales tax, so that perhaps now they are paying it, but these people are not new people that are they're coming in. They're probably people that have been there before. Mm-hmm. Any way of determining if that's a part of the reason for the increase in about tax?
I think that's certainly a factor. The Treasurer's Office and Ray Barney have been doing an excellent job in keeping tabs. We've been in frequent communication as we hear of places opening. We cross-reference lists and things like that to make sure that everyone's being contacted. And I know the Treasurer's Office is doing a great job that had not been done in the past. So I would certainly credit them with a lot of the effort that's gone in for collecting.
I won't belabor the point. Thank you.
Mr. Forsyth.
Ruth, I guess questions for you, or Renee isn't here, but do we have an accounting of what the bed tax is year-to-date as opposed to last year-to-date?
We do. I know that we talked about this last week as a part of budget, and our first two quarters were up. So far, traditionally, our third quarter has been our best performer, and inclusive of Bassmaster traffic this year, but we are down right now. So we're looking to see how this quarter finishes. But I can get you the numbers with exact dollar amounts.
But what was down?
This quarter so far, the third quarter, payments, yes. So I think one of the other areas that's worth mentioning is now that there is a tracking mechanism and much better reporting on this, that in situations where, as Mr. Lightfoot mentions, we may identify areas where occupancy tax may not have been remitted, we have the ability, the Treasurer's Office will be working with the County Attorney's Office to make contact and work to get those payments as well.
Okay. Brooke, a question on the website. You said the number of visits are up. Is there a specific area that is shining higher than others?
I'm trying to think. I didn't bring that with me.
Biking, hiking, camping, fishing,
mm-hmm.
If you can get it, that's fine.
Yeah, I'll follow up with you because I've done a bunch of different reports on different things, and so I don't want to misspeak, but I'll follow up with
third
that.
Question. I see that Waddington has pledged for 3 more years of the Bassmasters. Messina now has a function coming up this next year. How involved is the chamber? Have you been involved? Are you going to be involved? What's the relationship with both those?
Mm-hmm. So we've been in conversations with the Bassmaster Committee for several months now about transitioning kind of the administration of the event to the chamber. As some of you might know, they would like to take the money out of Waddington and have it somewhere else. And so we've been talking to them about us being that place for them. We're working out specifics of how much and in what way they would like for us to be involved. But it looks like a majority of it is going to be the administration of the funds. They applied for a Market New York grant that would ultimately, we would administer that grant. So we're still figuring out the fine details on what they want to keep control of and what makes sense for us to do that would be helpful in what you're looking for, as well as kind of take it off their shoulders. And we've been in conversations with Messina about their opportunities. FLW is committed. They also are looking at a couple of other opportunities. Ogdensburg has been contacted about opportunities. So we're trying to create a partnership opportunity that we're going to be able to offer to all those communities, recognizing that it's not just Waddington. FLW is a huge tournament as well.
Sure.
There are more boats. So you know, the festival aspect is not as large as Bassmaster requires, but there are more boats, so the economic impact is potentially higher in some ways. So I kind of feel like we need to be able to offer them what we would be willing to offer Waddington. So we're trying to figure out what that looks like for each of them. We did redesign and launch the fishcap.net site with a focus on tournaments and the ability for any of those communities or tournament coordinators to have essentially a micro site on that site, so that it's all in one spot and all the Isle of New York money that we're using to send to that site, they're getting exposure from there. And we've also applied for a grant through Northern New York Economic Development Fund, which is NYPA's power proceeds, to help facilitate more tournaments as well as other major events. So to be the kind of the coordinating arm of making sure all those things are scheduled so they're not overlapped, promoting them as a series, making sure that once we get those events here, that we as the chamber are leading the effort to make sure that business is developed around those opportunities. Because it's one thing to have these one-off events and have no place to stay or no guides to take people out, those kind of things. There's a lot of business opportunity that's not happening. So this year we were able to talk with some hotel developers at the Bassmaster event this year, and talking to them already about setting up those prospect meetings for next year as well.
Okay.
So those are some of the ways that we're...
All right.
Mr. Arquette.
Thank you, Joe. I wasn't in attendance at last week's Regional Economic Development Council meeting. I'm not sure if anybody here in the room was, but I thought he either heard or read that they reported from a regional standpoint that we had a significant increase on revenue generation directly attributable to tourism. Mm-hmm. I would have suspected maybe they would garner those numbers from, you know, your office or agency. Certainly, your efforts must be attributable to some of those successes.
I'd like to think so. I mean, that's the challenge, is that a lot of these counties have in their budgets, their large budgets, data collection every year in addition to occupancy tax. We don't have that, so we are able to kind of leverage off what the regions are doing. So I was just at an Adirondack Regional Tourism Council meeting where every year we allocate funds to look at the Adirondacks, and they do include the entirety of St. Lawrence County when they look at that. Some of the counties put in extra money so that there's a focus on Lake George or Lake Placid so that they can get more specific data. The committee the other day talked about spending money this year on trying to get more information from the Canadian market and how it impacts our counties. And so I think that's one where I've already told them we'd like to make sure that there's St. Lawrence County is highlighted and there's more specific data. One of the other challenges we have with data collection is that one thing that a lot of other destinations depend on for data, understanding occupancy tax occupancy rates. That's one of the main factors that destinations look at to gauge how well they're doing. It's pulled from something called the Star Report, which typically chain hotels pay into and then provide data to that. I think our county only has two hotels that participate in that, so it's not worth us buying into that data. Sure. So I'm always trying to find ways that we can get a better understanding. I was just at an ANCA meeting on Friday, and they're releasing a report that had a whole section on tourism, and I've been told that there's some detail on St. Lawrence County and tourism specifically. So I'll share that data as well as soon as I get it. But I'm always looking for data because it's hard for us to do our job too and know what we're doing without that.
Mr. Colbert.
A couple points I'd like to make. First of all, it's my opinion my understanding that occupancy tax is charged and collected for the purpose of tourism promotion. That being said, and if my understanding is incorrect, please correct me, but that being said, I think it only fair if we collect this tax that it should predominantly be going for tourism promotion, not for other general purposes. Obviously, the county should keep some for administration of the program and for monitoring who is paying and who is not. But government seems to have a habit of collecting taxes for one purpose and then using it for something completely different. Occupancy tax should be used for tourism promotion. That's what it's collected for. Another point I'd like to make, this doesn't necessarily have to do with tourism promotion, but the chamber in general. I attended their board meeting Thursday morning. And the chamber is, among other, they're doing some good things, but one of the things I wanted to bring up, membership income for 2017 was up $21,000 and change. So they've been doing some decent things over there, and salary expense was down $10,000 over that same period of time. So the chamber, in my opinion, they've been doing some decent things over there. So thank you.
Any other questions, comments? All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. Any old business to come before the committee? Oh, sorry. County Administrator report. Continue.
Just a couple other things. I wanted to bring your attention a schedule change that I'd like to request. When we're looking into November, this year, November 11th, Veterans Day falls on a Sunday, and we'll be recognizing that on Monday the 12th. So we have a scheduled Operations Committee meeting, and because we have only four Mondays that month, I'd like to request, if there's no objection, to move Operations to the 19th. So that would be a combined meeting, and generally we try and keep those through your summer months to allow for business to be conducted. But I think if we fit in Operations and Services on the 19th, that'll still give us the 26th for Finance. So if there's no objection, we can do that officially at the board meeting next week. Okay. The conference call I mentioned to you with Lewis and Franklin had to be rescheduled, so I was able to, Dylan and I sat in on the conference call on Friday. And if any of you recall or are familiar with the cost allocation plan that we do annually with the Vineski Group, this has the appearance of a similar nature. I'm going to share the data with Legislator Hooper to take a look at, but it's cost accounting. And what it will take into consideration is some blending with the rates associated with staff that we'll have and the variety of departments that will be attempting to respond and then seek reimbursement under Raise the Age legislation when it goes into effect October 1st. So it was interesting. Many of my colleagues, certainly the two that were on the phone from Lewis and from Franklin, will be at the conference this week, so I'll have an opportunity to flesh that out a little bit more with them and find out there's an interest in providing us with a reduced rate because we already do business with Vineski's. So we certainly would hold the normal process that we would in any situation like this. I am not aware of any other vendors providing this service. So something that they're still framing and trying to figure out the best method for sharing this information, but certainly interesting with so many unknowns associated with the legislation at this point. Work continues on the 2019 budget as well as 2018 projections. 2018 is shaping up well, and for 2019 we will be under the tax cap, and I'll bring the tentative budget presentation to you next week. News that was shared with me by the treasurer on Friday, we have officially been removed from having a designation as far as fiscal stress is concerned. So last year, if you recall, I shared with you, we were at 46.3. We were very close, I believe 1.3% away or 1.5% away from no designation. And this year we're coming in at 32. So while the metrics of the formula they use is probably longer than you'd like to spend listening to it tonight, it's drastic improvement. And I think one of the goals that the board had was to be in a place where we didn't have a designation for fiscal stress. So certainly, and certainly welcome news on that front. I want to remind you that the Walk with a Doc that the Public Health Department is bringing forward will be held this weekend. It's in Messina at the John Story Trail at Messina High School, and that's at 10 a.m. So they certainly welcome any and all of you to join them for that. I wanted to give you an update. If you noticed, when you came in this evening to the meeting, the courthouse doors and project is underway. It started last Tuesday with the first set of doors being removed, and then on Wednesday and part of Thursday, the asbestos abatement with the caulk associated with that, with the entrance there. So they're continuing their work. They're trying to minimize the interruption and the noise during business hours, and they have done an outstanding job in their first week of keeping a clean work site, as this is a highly trafficked area for the public. So I wanted to let you know that's going along well. We are back on the 9-to-5 schedule, so we now match again with the court's hours of operations, and we'll renew the conversation that they had requested prior to the summer hours with regard to additional space, potentially a courtroom. That is something that we have had some discussions about, and I imagine that we'll pursue that again with an understanding of exactly what they're looking for. We certainly always find ourselves crunched for space and certainly parking in this building, but it's something that certainly if we have information, I will bring back to you. And lastly, after the meeting tonight, I will join Renee for the NYSAC conference in Rochester. She's already there. I will be out tomorrow, back on Wednesday, but I'll be joining my colleagues to discuss the raise the age that I just mentioned, the internet sales tax passed post-Supreme Court decision as well, and I wanted to let you know that the president of our County Administrators Association will be sworn in as president of NYSAC, so certainly someone who understands the efforts on the front lines will be taking over as president at this meeting. And if there's any questions, I'll be happy to answer them.
Seeing none. Now, is there any old business to come before? I would like to commend our county administrator and her staff and this board for getting us off the stressed list. That's a big accomplishment. So I think this board can be proud and very proud of our staff. Any new business to come before? We do have a need for executive session for negotiations, personnel of a specific nature, and appointments. Do I have a motion to go into executive session? Mr. Perkins, second. Mr. Arquette, all in favor?
Aye.
Opposed?
Yes, for Don Stead.
Yeah. And we are in executive session. If no one objects, Mr. Chambers will be joining us. If no one but Mr. Chambers objects, Mr. Chambers will be joining us.
Thank you.